Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Ella Mates. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week we're joined by Dr. Chris Busby, all the way from Riga in Latvia. Chris asks whether or not the coronavirus is natural or if it's man-made. We also speak to Lucy Harper, a nutritionist who busts dietary myths. Finally, we are joined by Ellen Brown, who shares how to make money work for us rather than working for money. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at Dialect Radio, oneword.co.uk, and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm Dr. Chris Busby. I was once the scientific shadow minister for the Green Party of England and Wales. I'm a scientist. I specialise in epidemiology and I'm a chemical physicist. I work in the area of radiation risk, but I have a pretty sort of broad area of interest apart from that.
What do you make of this coronavirus outbreak? We've just heard the World Health Organization this week has now changed the official name of it. But there are all sorts of characteristics to this outbreak which look as if it's difficult to tell whether it's going to be enormous or actually fairly contained. What are your thoughts about how it's developed?
Well, I'm with you on that. I mean, it's difficult to tell whether it's going to be enormous or contained, but the people I talk to who, I mean, basically there are two kinds of news. There's a sort of, like, if you like, the theatre that we're subjected to and have been more or less since the Iraq War, and there's the real truth behind all of this. And you either live in the universe where you watch the theatre and you go up and down to work and you kind of believe everything that you've been told, or else you're rather like in the Matrix. You take that pill that actually puts you in quite an unpleasant place, but at least it's real. Now, in the case of the coronavirus thing, I'm at a bit of a loss to know which way to jump. But what I can say is I certainly don't believe the news. I mean, for example, I've had lots of information from all sorts of people. I have a lot of input from people from Eastern Europe and Russia. And there's a lot of input that I get that say that in China, in any case, at minimum, there are an awful lot more people dead than are being suggested by the theatre, by the news coverage, by BBC and CNN and New York Times and The Guardian and so forth. There's a suggestion that hundreds of thousands of people are dead. I mean, somebody has said that satellite photographs have shown all sorts of smoke coming out of crematoria and so forth. Of course, you know, the internet is full of this sort of stuff. And I've also been told by some people that it's not actually a virus at all, but people are being killed by the radiation from 5G. And this is a cover-up for that. Well, I certainly don't believe that. You can put that one to bed. I rather feel that it is a very serious outbreak, and there are an awful lot of dead people. I mean, mainly because it seems to me that there's an overreaction, or you know, a very big reaction behind the scenes relating to the way in which they're constraining people from China from going anywhere in the rest of the world.
Okay, so look, one of the big questions, which isn't really being addressed by our mass media, which it should be, is whether this is some kind of naturally occurring virus. Some people say it's jumping from one species to another, bats or you know, various different animals to, or pigs, whatever, to humans, or whether this virus is actually engineered. Because we know that in biowarfare labs around the world, although, you know, they're supposed to have been closed down, that scientists do and virologists do tinker around with the as potential weapons. So what's your thoughts about the origin of this, and you know, how we can tell whether it's a natural outbreak or whether this is something that's been human engineered?
Well, there appears to be some evidence about that the genome sequences of this particular virus are like a sequence addition to the SARS virus, from which you can argue that it's related to or derived from. and it contains various HIV gene links in sequences that are almost impossible to expect to occur randomly. So it does look as, I mean, and my money is on it being an engineered bioweapon of some sort.
The obvious question there is, is it originating in China or possibly taken there deliberately by an outside power?
Yes, well, I mean, when things like this happen, I always blame the Americans. In this case, I should think it seems to me to be certainly a possibility that they planted this in China. At the moment, the world economic sort of structure is imploding, and things are happening very, very quickly, and everything is deteriorating, in a rather alarming and dangerous way. And it would seem to me to be a very useful move for the people in the United States who want to control everything and who are frightened of China's economic dominance, to plant this sort of thing in the middle of China in some way. And I believe that there was some guy from Canada or some expert scientist who went over there and started to work for the Chinese, and possibly he was somebody who was sent there to do this. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if... Of course, this is all speculation, but the thing is that long ago I read a book by Her Majesty's Inspector of Salmon Fisheries in 1890 or something, and he said that if there's a hole in the bank of a river where a rat might feel a rat could live, happily, then you may be sure that a rat is living there. So I always look to see who might accumulate a profit or power, from any event. And in this case, certainly, it would be very valuable to the Americans to have the Chinese economic system shut down in this way.
Is there anything people can do if they're concerned about this? Because some people have suggested that actually wearing a face mask is really just a psychological thing. It doesn't stop the virus.
No, I think it probably does, actually. I mean, that isn't true for all sorts of radiation and so forth. But in this case, I think it probably would be valuable. The virus would be transmitted by aerosol, by spray. So somebody sneezing at you, and you could get the virus. So if you're wearing a face mask, it won't get through the face mask because it's just a little water droplet. So I think that probably would be useful.
Any other precautions, you think, if people get concerned?
Certainly usual precautions for viruses. You wash your hands. You don't move, all the time, because we're always taking our hands up to our faces and blowing our noses and this and that. And then if you sort of shake hands with somebody, or if you touch somebody, the virus should be communicated to your hands and so forth. So if you wash them, you wash the virus off. Really simple stuff, in fact. It seems to me anyway. Well, this is another thing, is that we're told by the BBC that the fatality rate is 1% or 2%. What my people tell me is the fatality rate is 10%. Now, that's quite a big difference. So, I mean, if 10% of people who get this die, then this is an awful lot of people. Of course, that fatality rate is going to be different, in different countries, depending upon, the level of healthcare and so forth. But I think the fatality rate is probably much higher than 1% or 2%. So it is something that kills you, but it doesn't kill everybody, and it will kill people with poor immune competence, like old people and people who are sick anyway, and children and so forth.
Now, one thing that's transpired is this guy that's come back to Britain to spread this coronavirus allegedly here in Britain. Obviously, he didn't do it on purpose, but we've heard, only got a very, very mild flu that he hardly noticed. So is it possible that different people of different races or different, something different about someone will influence whether this virus takes hold and, really shakes their body up, or whether they hardly notice it?
I would think that's probably quite likely. I mean, there's a range of responses to viruses, and there's also a range of abilities to survive an infection. I think that's probably likely. What was I going to say? Yes, look, the serious problem about this particular virus is it has an incubation period, as I understand it, of 14 days or more. So this is the difficulty in constraining constraining it and restricting its movement around the globe, you know, because the early symptoms of it are just like you've got a little cold and you're sneezing and coughing a bit and this and that. So it'd be quite easy for it to be transmitted around the world. I have to say, what's scary to me was that I was just getting a ticket on Wizz Air from Luton to Riga. So this is from England to, this is a Hungarian line, Wizz Air. And they had some notice up there, which I looked at while I was buying the ticket, and it said there may be some delays because we have medical teams at Luton Airport, you know, watching everybody that walks through the barrier and checking them out. So, and people are taking this very, very seriously. And I also saw a video of some American, some World Health Organization guy talking to some American generals about American forces in different parts of the world. And they were taking it very, very seriously. This guy said to them, this is like a second Chernobyl. This was a high-level meeting in the United States. So people behind the scenes, I can tell you, are taking this very, very seriously.
I know it's a very cheeky question to ask, but, I mean, if you had the benefit of hindsight in, say, a year's time, do you think this is going to be an enormous outbreak or a storm in a teacup?
I have no idea. We've been here before, you know, with Ebola and SARS and pig flu and goodness knows what. And so, you know, and very often they just turn out to be nothing at all. Few people die, and that's the end of that. So I don't know. But on the other hand, you know, at some point in time, this could easily be like one of those dreadful films, you know, that used to be shown in which everybody dies.
I'm reminded of the BBC, I don't know if you're old enough to remember it, Chris, the Survivors series from the 1975, whereas in that series, apparently only one in 20,000 people in Britain survived a virus. Nowadays, at least this one, you've got a better chance of survival.
Well, this is an HIV-tagged virus, right? So in other words, the first thing it does is it binds to the T cells, which are the immune system killer cells for viruses. So, you know, so if you like to think of yourself as the man, you know, as sort of like some kind of Doctor Strangelove or, you know, Goldfinger type character who wants to wipe out everybody in the world, this is how you'd go about it. You'd build a virus that had an immune system destructor to begin with, and then you'd send it out there.
Dr. Chris Busby, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Today I'm joined by Lucy Harper, who's a nutritional therapist, and she works for Nutritional Matters, so that's nutritional-matters. So Lucy, could you just tell me a bit about yourself and what you do and kind of what your work entails?
Okay, well, as a nutritional therapist, I'm a registered nutritional therapist with BANT, so that's the British Association of Nutritional Therapists and Lifestyle Medicine. And I work with clients who perhaps might want more energy, or they've got digestive issues, they might think they've got food intolerances, or they might be depressed or anxious. People can come for any number of reasons, but a lot of them are also weight issues.
So you say weight issues. Is that people kind of struggling with obesity?
Tends to be people who are struggling with being overweight.
Okay.
Yeah, haven't seen many people at all who are underweight. That's not to say I haven't seen anybody. I did have somebody who was ever so thin. Mm-hmm. But there was a very good reason for that. But most of the time, yeah, it's overweight.
And is there one diet you suggest to these overweight people, or does it kind of tend to vary?
Well, being overweight could be caused by so many things. It could be because of food intolerance. It could be because of hormonal imbalance. It could be because of toxins. It could be because of stress. There are so many different factors that contribute to weight gain. So, and there is no one good diet for anybody that you could say was suitable for everybody. Everybody is different.
Yeah, because I guess people tend to say the solution for obesity is just eat less, or don't go to McDonald's or something like that.
That's right.
But really what you're saying is it kind of completely depends on the person. If it does depend on the person, though, is there kind of a kind of all-rounded diet you suggest? Stay away from certain things, and do we follow the Eat Well plate?
Well, I would actually rename the Eat Well plate so that eat badly plate. We've had that plate for the last 40 years, I think, and obesity just keeps on going up. Yeah. Because the eat well plate is still advocating a high carbohydrate diet. So if there was anything I was going to say to do, if you want to lose weight, is to reduce carbohydrates. A lot of people feel that they forget that carbohydrates break down to sugar. So it's the same as eating sugar. And what we need to be doing is cutting down on sugar. But what's quite funny is a lot of people come and see me and they're surprised that I'm actually getting them to eat more, because I find so many people who are on a yo-yo diet, they eat so little. So it's obviously something else going on.
And do you think that this kind of yo-yo diet is kind of stemmed from social media? Because obviously there's a lot of things on the internet. You know, you type in diets on Google and it'll come out about a trillion different diets.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's so much nonsense out there and so much misinformation. And these diets might work for a very short while, but they're just not sustainable.
So Lucy, you spoke about carbohydrates. What kind of foods are carbohydrates? Because you say they break down into sugars, so could that be chocolate as a carbohydrate?
Yes, if it's full of sugar, definitely is a carbohydrate. But things like cereal, so many people have cereals that come straight out of a box and they are very high carbohydrates because they break down so quickly. So we've been, the Eat Well plate advocates whole grains. But some of those whole grains, like in bread, you get possibly whole grain bread, but it can be so highly refined, it's pure carbohydrate, and it will break down as quickly as sugar. Lots of people are not aware of that. The same with pasta. If it's very overcooked, it breaks down really quickly as well. If you undercook your pasta a little bit, that can make quite a difference as to how quickly it breaks down. So carbohydrates are basically things like bread, pasta, spaghetti, starchy vegetables are very high. So potatoes, rice are all high in carbohydrates. So when we say cut down on carbohydrates, we would look at reducing the amount of grains that we eat, going for more whole grains like perhaps quinoa, which is a whole grain and doesn't break down quite so fast, including more fats. Lots of people try and avoid fats, but it's what you need to be doing is avoiding the bad fats and increasing the good fats. So that when you do have a carbohydrate and you've got it with fat, it breaks down much more slowly and it sustains you for a lot longer.
So you say, you talk about, you know, kind of pasta and bread and stuff as kind of things that you should cut down on. I mean, I know as a uni student, carbs are basically your main fuel source. Is there kind of a healthier alternative? So would whole grain, would that be a good alternative?
It is, but you have to think how processed it is. So if it's a sort of very commercially produced loaf of bread, for instance, if it's cheap, unfortunately, it's going to be highly processed. If you're buying like a sourdough bread, that's much better for you because it's been allowed to ferment. It's much more natural. It breaks down much more slowly. But the other thing, it's what you combine your carbohydrates with. So if you can cut down a bit on your carbohydrates and perhaps increase good fats. And when I talk about good fats, I mean things like extra virgin olive oil, butter, peanut butter you could have.
Which people are scared of because
I know, because it's fattening.
Fats, yeah.
Yes, but that's where we've been getting it wrong. We've been cutting down fats and we've been replacing them with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we've got such a problem now. And people are so used to eating sugar, they're just not aware just quite how much sugar they're eating. But once you wean yourself off sugar, if you then go back to sort of what I call normal conventional foods, you find them horrifically, horrifically sweet. So the thing is, because sugar is so addictive, and that's been proven in research with rats, sugar's actually more addictive than, I think it was heroin they tested with rats, and rats preferred sugar. And amazingly enough, we're actually quite similar to rats, unfortunately.
Yeah. Love that comparison.
So that's definitely a sort of health message I would give, is try and reduce the sugar, increase on the good fats. And by good fats, I also mean seeds and nuts and avocados, healthy foods like that.
But then when you say reduce your sugar intake, people will often think, oh, well, I'll just go for a low sugar thing. Yes. Is that okay?
No.
I know there's so many, you know, you go to the supermarket, there's sugar-free this, sugar-free that. There's that famous ice cream brand Halo, which, yeah. I mean, I've bought it, and they do like 200 calorie tubs of ice cream. Is that a viable alternative?
That's a really good point you've raised there. No, and this is where we're going to get it really badly wrong, because yes, the message that we've got to cut down on sugar is getting through to people, but they're replacing it with synthetic sweeteners. Synthetic sweeteners have been shown to damage gut flora, gut bacteria, and your gut bacteria is really critical to your weight, and we want as much diversity of gut flora as possible. So if you're, it's been shown in research that if you replace sugar with sweeteners, you actually put on more weight.
Wow, so a Diet Coke really isn't going to make much difference to your McDonald's.
Not going to make any difference at all, not in the long run.
So back to you talking about processed foods and how they're essentially a much worse kind of source of nutrition. What would you say about vegan foods? Because I know that there is a big argument that vegan foods are healthy. There's been research done into the fact that some athletes now are having the vegan diet. But if you looked at something like a vegan burger or vegan corn mince or something like that, is that necessarily better for you than a chicken? Is it comparable?
It depends entirely on the quality. That's the thing. You can have a bad vegan diet in the same way as you can have a bad normal diet, if you like, or a bad vegetarian diet. It depends entirely on how processed it is and what the ingredients are. So you could have a good quality burger which is made with, say, free-range pasture-reared meat. That could be really good quality and good for you. Or you could have a perfectly good vegan burger. But generally in the vegan diets, what I find a lot of people are deficient in things like essential fatty acids is a big issue.
You could find
in oily fish.
Okay.
You can find it in seeds and nuts, but not in the same way, not in the same form as in, say, oily fish.
I mean, would supplements, would that do the trick?
Supplements would help. So
okay,
B12 is a major one. Some people can't absorb iron quite so well from vegetables as they can from meat. It's much more bioavailable in meat. So that can be an issue, but it depends on the person.
But even if, say, someone wasn't vegan, they ate everything else, they just didn't want to eat meat. There have been a lot of studies done into the fact that, well, meat itself, you know, it raises blood pressure, it causes cancer. As a nutritionist, are any of these studies viable?
Oh, that's a complicated question because it depends entirely on the quality of the meat. So what I would always advocate is actually having a balanced diet, which for me involves not too much meat and the best quality meat that you can afford. If you can only afford cheap factory-produced meat, don't buy it. Go be vegan or vegetarian. Yeah.
Yeah, because I suppose a lot of YouTubers out there on social media, they do advocate that it's a fashion trend, right?
It's a fashion trend.
And it can
certainly, people who are used to sort of eating lots of junk food and really poor quality meat and who are basing their diet on, say, carbohydrates and meat, if they suddenly become vegan, yes, that can be really good for them because it's forcing them to rethink their vegetables, which they might not hardly have eaten any of before. So from that point of view, from a health, sort of suddenly changing your health, it can be really beneficial. Long-term veganism, you really have to think about it and you do need to supplement.
Yeah, so because it's got to be a well-thought-out decision.
It has, yes.
So as a nutritionist, what would be, if you had one food which you could recommend to everyone, what would it be? One food.
One food. Oh, that is so difficult. Extra virgin olive oil.
Extra virgin olive
oil. Yeah, all cooking should be done in extra virgin olive oil if you can't have any other fat.
So, Lucy, recently I've been hearing about personally that it's a good idea to have a very small dinner and have a big lunch, have a big breakfast. I mean, is this just another kind of fad?
No.
Or is it actually a reasonable thing?
That's an interesting question, because there was a study where people were having exactly the same amount of calories throughout a day, but they were having them sort of at different times of the day. And they did find that this group of people who were having calories, the higher load of calories in the morning rather than in the evening, lost a lot more weight. And the reason for that is you can burn them throughout the day. But then it does depend what your breakfast is going to be. I think if you're someone who can make the time to prepare a nice breakfast and not just have, say, massive amounts of carbohydrates straight out of a box, like loads of cornflakes with skimmed milk, for instance, and skimmed yogurt or low-fat yogurt, that's not really going to do you much good. If you had a big breakfast that was also very healthy, so maybe having some protein with it,
okay,
which could be seeds and nuts, or it could be eggs, and it was high in calories, and then you had a lower calorie evening meal, something like a salad or a soup, then yes, that would be a good way of losing weight.
Why would it be good to eat less in the evening?
Because in the evening, you're not going to be burning it off so well. You burn very little throughout the night. So,
and what kind of breakfast would you suggest to have in the morning? Because I've personally heard that I ate a lot of porridge, and then someone said to me, oh, well, no, porridge is actually, it's meant to be a slow burner, but then you burn it off really quickly. And I'm just a bit confused by
yes,
that.
Yes, I'm not surprised you're confused. It depends. If it's the very refined porridge, you know, lots of people have microwaved porridge. So in order for it to cook really quickly, the grains, the oat flakes are really refined. So then it's just like sugar. They're right. But if you were to have traditional oats cooked slowly, ideally soaked overnight in water, because then they've got a higher nutritional value because you're unbinding the phytates in them. And then you cook them in whole milk, or it could be a dairy-free milk, but you add perhaps some fat. So if you're not vegan, you could add a lump of butter, which is what I often do. Or you add flaxseed, ground flaxseed. You add some seeds and nuts. That will slow it down a lot as to how quickly it gets burnt off. And that will keep you going for much longer.
I mean, you talk about these healthy fats such as butter. Would you suggest having these, but then also combining them with exercise? Because maybe some people would be scared of eating fats because they're like, I don't do a lot of exercise.
Yes, exercise. I mean, as a nutritional therapist, we look at lifestyle as well. So exercise and stress management all comes into it. And your sort of toxic load, how much time you spend in front of a computer, for instance, we look at all of that. But exercise is also really important for weight loss.
Because I know there was something about you have to do 30 minutes walking a day. Does it have to be intensive exercise, or can it be
there's some interesting
amount?
Studies on exercise. It's been shown actually that if you're doing sort of like sprinting, short, fast bursts of exercise, that's actually, you burn off a lot more and you don't have to exercise for anything like as long compared to if you were just doing a very regular amount of exercise, but for much longer. So if you were doing spinning, for instance, that isn't as effective as, say, doing a short burst exercise, which might be, say, walking really, really fast, or running, jogging for a short while, then resting for a bit, and then jogging again, and doing that really intensively for 20 minutes.
Okay, and as a nutritionist, I'm sure you get a few odd gym goers,
yes,
potentially.
Yes.
Do you recommend all those protein powder shakes? I know there's a big market for that right now.
There is a big market for it. And I'd only recommend it if you were really underweight, or if it was for a very specific purpose. But for your average person who's doing a bit of exercise, no.
So where can they find their proteins and those big bodybuilders?
If they really want to bulk up, then, and they're not getting very much protein, then they could use something like that. But the average person doesn't need them at all.
Yeah, just meats, fishes, stuff like
that.
Yeah,
seeds and nuts.
Okay.
And there's lots of protein in grains as well, but just sort of keeping it all in balance.
Okay. So, Lucy, just in case people kind of want to read up a bit more about nutrition or want to find out some recipes, who would you recommend to go to?
There's a lot of good books in the a bookshop, everybody likes different things. But someone like Chatterjee, Rowan Chatterjee, could be very good. You can also have a look at my website, Nutritional Matters, hyphenated. I've got some very useful tips on that. Or any other nutritional therapist who's BANT registered would be very useful.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much, Lucy. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Ellen Brown. I'm currently chairman of the Public Banking Institute. I'm also an author. I've written 13 books, three of them are on banking and specifically public banking and money and where our money comes from and what's wrong with our money system and where it went wrong. And before that, I was a lawyer in Los Angeles. And the Public Banking Institute has been going for 10 years now, and it's all about getting public banks set up, meaning we the people should own the banks. So recently, we've got AB 857 passed in California, which established a special charter for public banks. This would be municipally owned, government-owned banks, city, state.
That doesn't sound very American. It doesn't sound very capitalist to have public banks. I mean, surely the banks are at the heart of the capitalist system. They've got to be private enterprise, haven't they?
Yeah, one would think. Well, we have one stellar model, which is the Bank of North Dakota, and it's been around for 100 years. According to the Wall Street Journal, it's more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, but they're not even trying to be profitable. Their mandate is to serve the public interest, but it's just a more efficient model that they're just like a co-op. You know, the whole state works like a co-op, sharing their own profits, not sending it off to Wall Street and reinvesting them in their own communities. So they make below market loans. And all the state's deposits go in the Bank of North Dakota. Then we have, historically, we've had public banks and we've had government-issued money, which was the original colonial model. So that was what my first book on this subject was about, Web of Debt, where money comes from, how we lost the power to issue money. But it should be us issuing the money. In fact, according to the Bank of England, 97% of the money supply is created by banks when they make loans. So if we, the people, want to regain control of issuing the money supply, we need to recapture the banks.
Well, why does it make any difference who supplies the money? It's all money, surely.
Well, because it's a question of where the money goes. Who gets the loans, who gets the cheap loans, like right now our Federal Reserve itself, our central bank, is composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. And so it's effectively serving the banks. It's not serving the people. And just recently it's been pumping billions of dollars into the repo market, which is where not only banks but shadow banks get their liquidity, including hedge funds, which have done a huge amount of damage to local economies and local people, foreclosing on houses and, snatching them up cheaply and then renting them back to people at high prices. Anyway, we need to recapture that facility, the ability to, what banks do really is monetize the credit of the borrower. And they do it for us at credit card rates of 17%, and they do it for big hedge funds, big institutional investors at 2%, including big banks, of course. So not fair. We want the 2% rate for the public.
So you were saying at the beginning that you used to have public banks in the United States, and that actually right when you broke with the wonderful British Empire, that this was actually one of the first things that the United States did was to actually start to print their own money and have a different financial system to the bank, which I imagine at the time would be the Bank of England.
Well, they actually broke with that system quite a bit earlier, and according to Benjamin Franklin and others, that was one of the key triggers for the revolution, when the king said we could no longer issue our own money. And after the revolution, after we were our own country, well, the government or the Continental Army funded itself by printing money, the Continental, which did go pretty close to zero by the end of the war. But we won the war, which was pretty amazing, considering we had no money and we were just printing this paper. But Congress then was so, or the Continental Congress was so afraid of paper money that they left it out of the Constitution. So they only said, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the money, regulate the value thereof. They didn't say anything about paper money. They didn't say who had the power to issue it. And of course, the electronic money wasn't even an issue then. So the banks, that's what, I mean, it takes a whole book to explain all this, but that's what the banks then got in. There was no paper money supply. Well, there was at first with the first U.S. bank and the second U.S. bank, but they got shut down. So there was no national public money supply. So the banks issued their own money in the form of banknotes, which were actually supposedly receipts for gold. But on the fractional reserve system, which was first established by the Bank of England, they could issue 10 times as many notes as they had gold. So they were basically 90% of their notes were basically counterfeit. So they were issuing the paper money supply. So there's a whole history of that going back and forth.
But, I mean, some people have compared modern bankers, particularly these big private banks like HSBC, Deutsche Bank, to a kind of a feudal system from medieval times. Is that a comparison you think is justified?
In medieval times, we did have public banks.
I'm saying some people now are comparing the power and political power that the major banks have, such as people like HSBC and Deutsche Bank, to a kind of feudal system, you know, with the same degree of power, equivalent amount to the feudal barons, the kings and the dukes of the medieval times.
Yeah, well, that I've written about that too, that the England, among others, lost their feudal power, lost their colonies. Physically, lost physical control, but the way they retained control was through the money system, by setting up the central banking system, the Bank for International Settlements, wound up the head of it. At first, it was supposed to be the Bank of England, but after World War One, England was too poor to keep it up. So they joined with three other central bankers, which was Germany, France, and the U.S., and formed the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which is still the regulator of the central banking system, which is basically a private system. Or, you know, it's basically control by central banking. I saw that you, I'd be interested to talk about Iran, because I saw that you had done an interview on that and suggesting that Iran could issue its own money, helicopter money, and solve some of its problems.
Hang on, what is helicopter money?
Well, we know quantitative easing, which is what the central banks have been doing, where they pump money out, but the money goes into the reserve accounts of banks.
Okay, well, this is what they used to call printing money.
Well, that's quantitative easing, but helicopter money is something different. According to what, I mean, the term was first coined by, it was Milton Friedman who first talked about how it would be easy to fix the deflation. You just fly with helicopters over the country and drop money on the people, basically. So you're dropping money into the wallets of the people. So that's what helicopter money is supposed to be. It's supposed to get to the people somehow, like with a universal basic income, which I think is the best way because it's the fairest and you don't have wrangling about who gets the money. But you could also do like forgive student debt or make free college tuition or Medicare for all, or, you know, an infrastructure bank. There are many things you could do with helicopter money, but the idea is to get it into the real economy and not just into the reserve accounts of banks, because all the banks can do with it is make loans, and the economy is already all loaned up. I mean, everybody's heavily in debt. Governments are heavily in debt. Consumers are heavily in debt. Businesses are heavily in debt. And so that's why we have a recession. Is that it's not possible to get more money in the system unless people borrow. And when they get too loaned up, then they start paying down their debts. And if you pay down debt, then you shrink the money supplies. So the central banks are all trying to pump up the economy by pumping up more lending, but there's nobody else that wants to borrow except the big speculators. And they are borrowing for a totally different economy. The speculative economy or the financialized economy is something totally different from the real productive economy where consumers go to shop. So if you want to increase productivity, you got to get some money into the pockets of consumers, and that's what helicopter money is supposed to be.
So who's in charge? The politicians we elect, Sajid Javid, the Treasury Secretary, Boris Johnson, or the banks? Because it seems that the politicians always have to go cap in hand to the banks to say, we'd like to do this, please. And that is a bit of a, you know, there is a bit of a problem, isn't there, in trying to persuade the banks to fund things which are socially responsible. They want to fund things which are profitable.
Right. And that's the problem with the private banking system. That's their mandate. That's their business model, is to make as much profit as they can for their shareholders and also for their executives who get all these, you know, stock buyback plans and so forth. And it, to do that, it's virtually always at the expense of the real economy. So they're not serving the real economy. They're extracting or exploiting or a parasite on the real economy.
So, I mean, who's in charge? The bankers or the politicians?
The bankers. But they're pretty much in cahoots nowadays, it seems like. I mean, even if they don't mean to be, like, I'm sure many politicians go into the game hoping, expecting, wanting to do something for their people, but they wind up serving the bankers because they have to, or serving big money because that's the only way they can retain their seat.
You're painting a picture of a money system which is, you know, actually kind of almost enslaving people. Is there anything we could do, really basic? I mean, if you were sitting in the Whitehall at the Treasury, what would you do? Is there anything you can do to actually turn it around to make money a servant of humanity again, rather than enslaving us in debt?
Yeah. Well, the Treasury could issue money directly, or Congress could vote to borrow, to issue more bonds and have a deal, actually make a deal with the central bank that the central bank will buy the bonds and not sell them back into the market, but just hold on to them. So that's basically what Japan does. They are allowed under their banking laws, which are different from ours. They're actually allowed to, or supposed to, the government is supposed to work with the central bank. So that's what Prime Minister Abe has done, is actually collaborate with the central bank and say, we want to fund this program, you know, for all this development. And we're going to issue bonds and we want you to buy them. And so now the central bank owns, I think, close to 50% of the national debt of Japan, and still their inflation rate is barely up to two, they're not even up to 2%, which is what they're aiming for. So their objection to either the Treasury printing its own money or going to the central bank, which would print money and not require that this loan be paid back, and return the interest to the Treasury, the objection is always that this would be inflationary. But we have many models to show that's not true. Right now, the way they do it, it's not inflationary because the money doesn't get into the real economy. But you actually need to get money into the real economy to stimulate productivity. So the Chinese, for example, increased their money supply by 18 times, a factor of 1,800% in the last 20 years. And their inflation rate is still around 2%. So why is that? It's because they increase their GDP at the same rate. So our country, too, we probably don't have as much room to grow as they do, but we could certainly pump some extra money out there in the form of maybe a universal basic income, which would put money in people's wallets, and then they would go shopping, which would stimulate businesses to produce more. And that's how you get an economy going.
Now, you mentioned briefly Iran. We might also talk about Colonel Gaddafi and Libya. Some people say that this is one of the reasons that these Islamic states have been and are being targeted is because they have a different banking system. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Right. Well, both of them are not members of the Bank for International Settlement. And, you know, in 2001, well, I think it was 2007, remember his name, General Wesley Clark said on Democracy Now! That he had been told, like, a week after September 11th, that the decision had been made to go into Iraq and that they were going to take down seven countries in the next 5 years. So that included Iraq, Syria, Libya, Iran, and three others, which they have definitely gone after. And Venezuela. So what do all those countries have in common? They're all not members of the Bank for International Settlements. So they can't be manipulated by BIS rules. So Iran could just print its own money. Libya certainly did that. And Libya had its own gold, and it was self-sufficient for water because of that great man-made water project. So they were all set to show the rest of Africa how to break free of the Western system. And, of course, we couldn't have that, so we had to go after Libya and crush them. And Venezuela, too, was Chavez, the Bolivarian Revolution was basically about all the Latin American countries getting together and having their own money system so that they would be independent of the U.S. and the other exploiters. And we couldn't have that either, so we had to shut them down.
I mean, it sounds to me almost as if U.S. foreign policy, and maybe the British to a lesser extent, you know, is driven by this wish to get all nations under the control of the Bank for International Settlements. I'm just amazed that we've never heard of this bank, even though it seems to be the spider at the center of the web.
Right. Yeah, they've kept a low profile, obviously, on purpose. And then, you know, I am an American. We get blamed for everything, but it's not we the people. It's somebody up there. You could call it the deep state or, you know, the banks have gotten control or whatever, but there is some sort of parasite that is sucking us dry as well as everybody else. Well, I mean, Americans, you know, most people, if they're not in the stock market, they aspire to be in the stock market. I mean, people would like to be exploiters like everyone else that's held out to be a model. Like if you don't have to work for a living and you can actually live off your investments, that's what people actually want. But my point is that it's not part of the American, it's not in the constitutional, it's not constitutional money. It's not, you know, it's not the American dream. It's not what Americans think they're voting for when they vote their candidates in, but somehow it always winds up that way because there is some form of deep state control.
I mean, what can we do? What can ordinary people do? Anything? Because it sounds as if, you know, most of these mechanisms for controlling the financial system of the world are far too far away from ordinary people and even the decisions that we make, the politicians we elect.
Yeah, I think that's one reason that it's hard to get people to really delve into these issues because it's discouraging. It's like, well, you know, do you even really want to know if there's nothing you can do about it? But what we do, the Public Banking Institute, we feel like if we could set up an alternative model and just sort of creep into it, it's easiest to approach your local legislators. So you can really, like we had a bill a year ago, it got 44% of the vote, which it didn't win, but that was 44% of 4 million people for a city-owned bank in Los Angeles. And they're going to bring the bill again now that AB 857 has passed, which sets out a special charter and the requirements. And that's, you know, that's the city of Los Angeles, which is not a small city. So if you are in a small city, you can approach your local legislators and show them the wisdom of getting back the power over money that we could get by setting up our own banks.
I mean, if you were chatting, say, to the mayor of Bristol City Council, Marvin Rees, you had a word in his ear, Ellen. I mean, what would you say? Could you say, you know, something in a nutshell to say, well, you know, this is why you need to take public banking seriously?
Well, one thing I think nobody really understands is that banks actually create money, and that by putting your investments and your deposits and your investment money into a big, City of London bank, you are giving away that power, and you could take that power back by forming your own bank. And so not only can you stimulate the economy by making all sorts of credit that wasn't there before, you can direct it into your local economy, and you get the profits instead of City of London.
Now, you mentioned something I think called the bank. Is it the Bank of North Dakota? What has that achieved?
What would that do? Say it again.
I'm just imagining where you and I are whispering, maybe one in one ear, one in the other ear, of the mayor of the city here, and saying, well, look, you know, there's this bank in North Dakota, and this is what they've achieved.
Yeah, totally. And the Sparkasm banks are a network of public banks that are also highly successful. So those are our two best models. Although China also, I mean, they generate their own money all the time. That's where they got that 1,800% increase in their money supply, was that they just borrow from their own banks, which just create the money on their books. And if the loans default, they don't put the bank into bankruptcy. They don't put the businesses into bankruptcy because it doesn't serve their purpose.
It would be nice to hear a politician that didn't say, oh, well, I'm very sorry, we can't do that, because we don't have the money. Anyway, Ellen, I wonder if you could just tell us how we can follow your work and maybe some of the books that you've done.
Yeah. So the Public Banking Institute is at publicbankinginstitute.org. That's our website. And my own website, where I have must be close to 400 articles now on this subject, is ellenbrown.com. And then I've written 13 books, which are all on Amazon. My latest book is called Banking on the People. And then my two others are called The Public Bank Solution and Web of Debt.
I mean, are there any books for anyone that's sort of thinking, well, actually, this is a massive issue, as a first thing to read, as an introduction to the whole topic?
Well, of my books, or I have lots of articles on my website, but of my books, I guess Web of Debt is the best, because it takes it from the beginning and, you know, gets you into what the issues are, and it does end with public banking.
Okay, Ellen Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. Great talking to you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen to on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Lucy Harper, Chris Busby and Ellen Brown, and to our studio engineer, Dave Bazanko, and producer, Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us. Or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain, via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialects, and I'm Ella Mapes, wishing you a very good week. Tony will be back on Friday with his 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
It's not the way that you say it when you do those things to me. It's more the way that you mean it when you tell me what will be. And when you stop and think about it, you won't believe it's true that all the love you've been giving has all been meant for you. I'm looking for someone to change my life. I'm looking for there lies a land I once lived in, and she's waiting there for me. But in the gray of the morning, my mind becomes confused between the dead and the sleeping and the road that I must choose. I'm looking for someone to change my life. I'm looking for a miracle in my life. And if you could see what it's done to me, to lose the love I knew, could safely lead me to the land that I once knew. The land as we grow, the secrets of our soul. You say it when you do those things to me. It's more the way you really mean it when you tell me what will.